Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump came face-to-face with Xi Jinping for the first time yesterday after months of aggressive rhetoric from the new U.S. president towards China. As the meeting continues today, taking up controversial issues such as the South China Sea, Taiwan, North Korea, and trade policy, will tensions grow or will they ease? Or will the hostile posture of Trump towards Beijing even continue? We are joined today for the full hour to discuss the meeting by David Ewing. He is the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. We're also joined from London by Keith Bennett, a China expert who has visited the country hundreds of times and currently advises both British and Chinese companies. Welcome back, David and Keith.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Good to be back.
Yes, good to be back, too.
David Ewing, what do you expect to come out of this much-anticipated summit? Of course, it takes place in the context of other very dramatic world events that in some way overshadowed the meeting sort of at the last minute. And I'm speaking, of course, on the reports that there were chemical attacks in the northern province of Idlib in Syria and the possibility that the U.S. government under Trump will begin airstrikes or missile strikes against the Syrian government. That's in the background, though. Talk about what you think will be happening between Xi Jinping, the leader of China, and Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's really hard to speculate, for me, to speculate about what may happen. You know, of course, President Trump has said that he wants to focus on trade, which is, he made lots of campaign promises that will be hard to fulfill, I think. And then he also said that for him, what he calls the North Korean problem is also a really big issue. So, of course, they'll talk about that, but I don't see an easy way forward on either of those points. So probably this may end up as sort of a get-to-know-each-other meeting, and if that's all it is, I would probably settle for that. And I just hope things don't go badly.
Yeah, Keith Bennett, there's a lot of tension around this meeting, usually because of decorum, because of protocol. Everybody sort of kind of knows what's going to happen at the meetings, but there's been a lot of tension because, of course, Trump is an unpredictable element. There's also been so much tension generated by the Trump administration towards China on the One China policy and on the issue of protectionism. The morning of the summit, Trump appeared, this was yesterday, on the morning news show Fox and Friends, and he said of his meeting with Xi, "Well, it's going to be very interesting. Nobody really knows. We have not been treated fairly on trade for many, many years. No president's taken care of that the way they should have, and we have a big problem also with North Korea. Well, we're going to see what happens." In other words, Trump and also the comments by Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, just after Xi Jinping landed, a kind of tough talk. What do you think?
I think this is a very difficult and unpredictable summit for both objective and subjective reasons. Objectively, I think it's difficult because there are many difficult issues between China and the United States, and that would be the case irrespective of who was the president. The fact that they are compounded by the fact that the president of the United States is who he is just serves to make the situation worse, but it would be the case anyway, and a number of those issues are reaching a rather acute stage at the moment.
What's the most acute? What's the biggest issue, the biggest stumbling block in U.S.-China relations from your point of view?
Well, I think there are a number of issues, but I would say that at the moment, the most acute problem is the question of North Korea. I don't think that that's the issue that China traditionally regards as its basic red line with the United States. But I think the United States is making it that red line, whether China wants it or not.
David Ewing, do you see it that way? Of course, the North Koreans, just prior to the beginning of the summit, did another missile test. They're obviously working hard to improve their missile technology, their nuclear capability. From the point of view of the DPRK, this is both a life and death struggle. In other words, they consider nuclear weaponry possessed by them and developed by them to be existentially important to their existence in the face of what they consider to be endless U.S. threats and provocations. They also, the North Koreans also believe that by having an enhanced nuclear arsenal, that they can divert less of their money to conventional weapons and use more of that money to provide for people's needs. In other words, consumer goods, etc. North Korea is not going to step back from being a nuclear power. What do you think? Does China have leverage? Is it willing to use leverage over North Korea?
I don't think China has much leverage with North Korea, and I don't think it's particularly in China's interest to do things now that will harm North Korea, because I see the North Korean problem as not something that's sort of an independent issue between China and the U.S., but the tension in North Asia reflects the wider tension in the Pacific and the East China Sea, and the steady pressure that the U.S. is bringing to bear on China through its expansion, through its the disputes over China's island territories, disputes about natural resources, the U.S. Taking the sides of other countries against China, the attempt by the U.S. to construct an international trade agenda that limits China or excludes it somehow. All of this, I see the North Korean issue as part of that larger problem. And I think the way the Chinese see it is the particular issue of the THAAD defense system that the U.S. is building in South Korea, the missile defense, supposedly defense system that is directed at North Korea, is really, I think the Chinese believe, it's really directed at them. And this is true for all of the military initiatives that the U.S. is taking in the Western Pacific. So I think from China's perspective, it appears to them that this is all military pressure building against them. So I don't think it's particularly in China's interest to, put undue pressure on North Korea. And while North Korea is suffering this kind of military posture from the U.S., where they just finished a round of military exercises involving 100,000 troops, I think, to practicing amphibious landings against the North Koreans. With that kind of military activity, I think it's hard for China to press the North Koreans on this. And it's really not in China's interest. The THAAD system threatens China as much as it threatens North Korea. So it's kind of a bigger picture of what's going on. And although President Trump wants to limit it to the North Korea problem, it's actually a problem of aggression against China by the United States, I think. Probably Xi Jinping sees it that way.
Keith Bennett, Ronald Reagan employed the so-called full-court press against the Soviet Union and the countries of Eastern and Central Europe in the early 1980s. A rapid expansion of U.S. military power, military spending, the placement in Europe of intermediate-range missiles, some of which had like a six-minute flight time to hit Soviet political targets. In other words, a lot of pressure, and the Soviets responded very defensively, very aware that something bad could happen, even by mistake. It raised the tensions, and at the same time, the United States began a more active sort of CIA-based outreach to countries and governments and parties and trends and tendencies both within Eastern and Central Europe and perhaps within the USSR itself, trying to project sort of a second track. In other words, to undermine the Soviet Union by creating a new set of non-governmental alliances and to create divisions within the Soviet Union and within the political leadership there. Do you think that it's possible that the Trump administration, being advised now by all of the neoconservatives and the so-called liberal hawks, and given what he's been doing and been saying, is it possible that the Trump administration and the U.S. imperial foreign policy establishment sees that within China there could be divergent opinions, say, over North Korea, and additional pressure on North Korea or on China over North Korea could lead to some sort of fissure inside the establishment inside of China? Is that one possible scenario here?
Well, I think there's several aspects to your question. First of all, whatever the United States does in terms of its military encirclement of China or its military build-up vis-a-vis China, it's already the case that in straight military terms, the United States is far, far more powerful than China. And China is acutely aware of that. Of course, it's taking steps to increase its military might. But China's under no illusions that it can just eliminate the military gap between itself and the United States, either overnight or even over the immediate future period. So they're not going to get drawn into that kind of arms race that really bled the Soviet Union. What the Chinese will do, they'll do a number of things, obviously, but one of the things they'll do, I think, is to act what you might call asymmetrically. For example, with the kind of pressure that they're putting on South Korea over the THAAD development that David mentioned a moment ago, where they can actually make some progress, not by focusing on the United States directly, but around its periphery. And we have, as listeners will know, we've had recently the impeachment and the removal from office of the South Korean president, who was a very right-wing president, the daughter of the military dictator, who pursued very hardline policies against North Korea and was very close to the United States. We have presidential elections on May the 9th in South Korea, which are expected to return a candidate to office who will be less amenable to Washington, more amenable to coming to an agreement over THAAD with China, more amenable to talks with the North Koreans. And China's had considerable success in neutralizing and winning over quite a few of the countries around China that the United States was trying to pull to its side. We've seen that with Vietnam, and most strikingly, we've seen it with the Philippines. Within China itself, I think again there are two aspects to this. One is that I think that the threat of using NGOs and so-called civil society to undermine the Chinese government and the rule of the Communist Party is a less effective tool in the Trump arsenal, at least up to now, as compared to the Democrats, because Trump himself has, for whatever reason, very little time for the human rights rhetoric. He's cutting back funding to NGOs under one pretext or another, for example, Planned Parenthood issues, and is slashing the State Department and foreign aid budgets in terms of hard military power. That kind of weakens weakens to some extent the United States' ability to implement a kind of Trojan horse strategy in China.
Let me jump in and throw this back over to David Ewing. I agree with Keith Bennett, David, that Trump has not, in the main, been harping on human rights. He's been real politic and spheres of influence, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems also to be changing, certainly because of the Syria situation, the potential rapprochement with Russia may be coming to an end. That was part of the neocon agenda in Washington to move Trump away from that. And at the same time, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, like an hour after Xi Jinping landed in Florida, said, we're going to have very candid talks, very frank talks, in other words, using undiplomatic language and to talk about hard discussions. And he put on the agenda not only North Korea, not only on trade, but human rights and the freedom of religion in China. I mean, how is the Xi Jinping government going to react to that under the current circumstances?
Yeah, it seems again that, and we've seen this before with President Trump, is that when he's in a bind, he'll play to his base, you know, so that these kinds of themes about rolling back the advantages or the unfair advantages that the Chinese have over the U.S. in trade, or freedom of religion, even though their freedom of religion or these human rights elements are inconsistent with his actual policies overseas. It's in a sense he just has to, and when he's in his corner, he plays to that base. So it might be that that's what's happening. And I think that it's better from a political perspective internally to the U.S. anyway, for the president and spokesman to talk tough now, before the actual meeting, then it sort of raises the stakes at the meeting for the Chinese. And then afterwards, after the meeting is over, the president can claim accomplishments that he was very frank with Xi Jinping, and you know, they now understand each other, and we're going to move forward with this and that, and we told them what we need on trade and this, and now the ball's in China's court. So there'll be stuff like that, possibly, you know. But that's kind of, again, playing to the president's base. And so many of the themes from the Trump administration seem unsettled and contradictory. And, you know, he wants to be the U.S. wants to be the leader of Europe and, you know, a strong NATO and more defense spending. At the same time that the president during the campaign sort of emphasized pulling back from the Middle East, pulling back from the NATO commitments. So there, it's just, we are seeing the working out of contradictory drives within American conservatism, I think. It's isolationism versus internationalism.
All right, we're going to pick that theme up when we come back. You are listening to David Ewing and Keith Bennett. We're talking about Xi Jinping's meeting with Donald Trump in Florida. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the visit of Xi Jinping to meet with Donald Trump in Florida at his exclusive country club. He calls it the White House, the Southern White House, whatever. It's an exclusive country club for millionaires. We're speaking with David Ewing. He is the chairperson of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. And from London by Keith Bennett, a China expert who has visited the country hundreds of times and currently advises both British and Chinese companies. Keith Bennett, Sputnik News, of course, we're on Radio Sputnik, but Sputnik News website had an interview with someone from the Russian Academy of Sciences. And this is what, his name is Vladimir Vasilov. He's the chief researcher at the Institute for U.S. and Canadian Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences. He says this, quote, "The Americans prepared this visit quite hastily, and perhaps it's not very well thought out. But the rush came as a result of the missile tests carried out by the DPRK. Pyongyang said it is preparing to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, and if the tests are successful, the territory of the U.S. will be in danger." Do you agree with that, that that's what's driving the summit, or the what he calls the hastily arranged character of the summit?
I think, as I said earlier, that the DPRK, the North Korean issue, has been pushed right to very high up the agenda of this summit. And indeed, Trump made no secret of that in the interview he gave that was published in the Financial Times on Monday. But I don't think that that was the original impetus for the summit. I think the original impetus for the summit was partly that U.S.-China relations entered into a period of great uncertainty with the election of Trump. First of all, because Trump had spent his entire campaign criticizing and attacking China in very intemperate ways right throughout his campaign, and then that was followed up by the telephone call with the leader of Taiwan and the questioning of the One China policy. So this brought the U.S.-China relationship to an impasse, and U.S.-China relations are so important that I'm sure that there were many people in Washington who were perturbed by this. From the Chinese point of view, they also definitely do not want U.S.-China relations to go into a nosedive and would be looking for ways to establish some kind of rapport with a president who, perhaps on a business level, some people in China have had dealings with him over the years, but politically is somebody who is really an unknown quantity to the Chinese. And I think that the Chinese officials have certainly pressed for this visit. China's most experienced diplomat, Yang Jiechi, came to the United States to negotiate on it. The Chinese have been trying to find some way into the Trump administration, which they seem to have done by building relations with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump in particular. And so the Chinese have won, but nevertheless, Chinese officials are quite, from ones that I've spoken to, are quite apprehensive about this summit, because normally when two heads of state meet, things have been pretty much scripted in advance. And that's even more the case, one would think, when it's the leaders of the world's two biggest economies. But in this case, as we've discussed, Trump is pretty unpredictable.
Yeah, and it seems to me that the stakes are quite a bit higher, David Ewing. I want to ask both of you this. Quite a bit higher for Xi Jinping than Trump, because if it goes badly, I mean, no big deal with Trump. I mean, Trump has played this kind of role in American media, bouncing off of the most outrageous things. And of course, the media just constantly dotes on him, whether they give him some negative coverage now. Nonetheless, he commands and dominates the stage, the media stage. If something bad were to happen, it wouldn't be considered a big deal at all for Donald Trump, and certainly not for his base, the people who voted for him or for the Republican Party, which, you know, is inherently unfriendly to and hostile to China. But what about for Xi Jinping and his stature within China if something really bad goes down? Or, for instance, if the U.S. starts carrying out military strikes against Syria in the middle of this visit, which under the circumstances, that's possible, if not during the summit, maybe in the days right after the summit. Go ahead, David.
There's always in assessing the damage or the success that President Trump will have, there's always the issue about how much actual knowledge he has and how familiar he really is with world issues. So, for example, an aggressive tone with the Chinese, and suppose that after the summit ended, the president announced that he was going to impose sanctions on Chinese imports or something. Something like that might have an immediate, for at least for his base, might have an immediate positive political impact, but it would be very short-lived because the American working people are not paid very much, and to raise the price of all the commodities that they need to survive makes it hard for industrialists to run their factories. You have to think about paying their workers more. So this kind of trade imbalance, a real trade imbalance, would be to put sanctions on Chinese products that raise the price of everything that Americans buy, and that you'd have an effectively lower wage standard, then you'd have to raise it. So, I mean, it'll cause unpredictable, but I think very severe disruption of the U.S. economy, and not over the long time, but maybe over the short time or over the immediate term. You'll see Wall Street firms immediately adjusting as soon as such measures are imposed by the U.S. So it's just it'll have a very bad effect, and it'll hurt the president, I think, if the hearing goes badly. Will it hurt President Xi Jinping? I think there is a growing consensus in China that people are feeling a little embattled now. And China is open to the world, so people have access to American news, and much more so than Americans do. The Chinese people have access to the world news. So it's. I think that there could be a rallying around President Xi Jinping if he stands up to President Trump. So I just don't know. I'm sure the Chinese want a happy outcome if they can get it, but I think that President Xi Jinping has to stand firm. And that's his best position, not only because it makes him look better, but it's a more reasonable way to have a good relationship with the United States in the long run.
Keith Bennett, same question to you.
I think that, first of all, obviously the Chinese, both the leadership, the Chinese government, and public opinion in China would like to have what David has called a happy outcome to this meeting. If Trump is seen to treat Xi Jinping badly, or if there's something dramatic happens, whether around airstrikes on Syria, leading to a public row between them, something like that, then I think that that people in China will be very angry. But I don't think that the anger will be directed at Xi Jinping. Public opinion in China is very patriotic. We've seen it recently. For example, in the boycotts of South Korean goods over the THAAD issue, which is not really driven by the Chinese government, it's driven by public opinion, by some of the demonstrations that have been held, for example, outside the Lotte South Korean stores in China. We saw it very dramatically, of course, at the time back in the late 1990s when the United States bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. So the fact that Xi Jinping has taken on vested interests in China in terms of taking down a lot of corrupt people and pursuing the struggle against corruption has made Xi Jinping very, very popular among public opinion and among ordinary people in China. And I think that if Trump is seen to treat Xi Jinping badly, that will be taken by people in China not as just something directed against Xi Jinping in person, but as an insult to everyone in China.
David Ewing, the Japan Times reports, quote, amid such high stakes, Xi plans to offer win-win gifts calculated to make it easy for Donald Trump to make concessions while burnishing his hard-charging deal-making public persona. Top of the list, according to a source briefed on Xi's plans, will be a package of Chinese investments aimed at creating more than 700,000 American jobs, the number pledged to Trump by China's regional rival, Japan, during Prime Minister Abe's February meeting at the same place at Mar-a-Lago, the golf course. Do you think that Xi Jinping will do this? In other words, give win-win gifts to Donald Trump so he can tweet about, oh, I made the Chinese give me jobs and I made the Chinese do this. In other words, just playing to Trump's psychic?
I think that would be great. You know, remember with the carrier company that produces air conditioners, I think he saved 30 jobs or something, or 100 jobs. And this was touted as an immense achievement, you know, in his early days, before he was president, actually. So something like that, something that really is fairly meaningless economically to either country, but it's the kind of bait that we've seen President Trump rise to before. So maybe that is a win-win.
Keith Bennett, how important is the Chinese economy and specifically Chinese direct investment for the U.S. economy? Of course, we know that since the opening of China in the late 1970s, China has courted U.S. and Western corporations and has been the target of direct investment, direct foreign investment from these companies who have made, you know, large, you know, super profits by their investments there. In exchange, China got not only employment, but technology transfer that's allowed China to rapidly develop. But what about now? Is China a factor in the U.S. economy from the point of view of Chinese investments? And is it possible that China could offer Trump some sort of major role for Chinese either state-owned enterprises or private enterprises in an infrastructure program?
Well, I think that Chinese investment in the United States is rising. And there, have been a number of headline deals or headline projects. But in terms of the overall amount of investment stock, Chinese investment in the United States, I would say, is still pretty insignificant. But what that also means is that there's a huge potential for it to grow in the future. And I think this is the kind of deal that could be quite attractive for both sides, in that if China pledges some investment and various things that I've seen have been talked about, for example, possibility of investment into, you know, what are considered Trump or, you know, battleground states in the U.S., such as Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin, or support for an infrastructure fund, which would very much play to Trump's base and to the things he's promised. And you could have something here where basically it's a kind of win-win situation, as the Chinese like to say, in that Trump can present it as a triumph. But China has up to now been often frustrated by the suspicion or even blockage of some of its attempts to invest in the United States. So what Trump can proclaim as a big victory for his policies and his facing down the Chinese is actually giving the Chinese what they wanted and what suits them in the first place. Big question, of course, with Trump making an issue of North Korea and North Korea being very much in the news, and now we have the Syrian issue coming up. The question is, are those economic agendas where actually there is, I think, considerable scope for some kind of face-saving thing that pleases both sides? But the question is, will those be overshadowed or perhaps spoiled by international security issues? We have to wait and see. And on this, I think one of the issues is that I think it's actually, so long as there's not a big row or something very dramatic around Syria and so on, in general terms, it's easier for Xi Jinping to come out of this feeling that he's got something out of it than it is for Trump. Because for Xi Jinping, this is about a kind of getting to know you visit and just to kind of stabilize the state of Sino-US relations. Xi Jinping doesn't come with a big list of demands of what he wants the United States to do. He doesn't come having promised the Chinese people, I'm going to make the Americans do this, I'm going to make the Americans do that. It's Trump who spent up to and including today, it would seem, you know, the last year and a half or whatever, you know, saying how he's going to make the Chinese do this, he's going to stand up to the Chinese over that, and so on. And it's actually Trump who is going to have to come away from this, even with the kid glove treatment he gets from much of the media, to explain what it is he has actually got the Chinese to do.
Okay, that's the voice of Keith Bennett. We're talking with Keith Bennett and David Ewing about the visit of Xi Jinping to Florida to meet with Donald Trump. We're going to continue the discussion. We want, in our next segment, to talk about both the economic policies of China and the United States, how intertangled the two countries' economies are, and how those prospects for economic cooperation could be overturned or disrupted by global political confrontation in different regions of the world. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're joined today for the full hour to discuss the meeting of Xi Jinping and Donald Trump. We're talking with David Ewing. He's the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. And from London, we're speaking with Keith Bennett, a China expert who has visited the country hundreds of times and currently advises both British and Chinese companies. David Ewing, in a meeting like this, in a summit like this between the United States and China, or if it was the United States and Russia, we understand that there's context. Some of the context is political. The leaders have constituencies and political needs and contradictions on their home fronts. That's one thing. And then there is, of course, the relationship between the two countries, between China and the United States, certainly one of the dominant, most important relationships in global politics. We have right now the uncertainty of Donald Trump, an unpredictable force politically. Certainly his comments about China in the past months during the on the campaign trail and then even after he was elected president would be seen, would be perceived by China as threatening, as something that would disrupt what China values most, which is stability in its bilateral relations with the United States. And he said, of course, why should we have a one China policy? He reversed that later in a discussion with Xi Jinping. He said that China is a currency manipulator. Now they're about to meet. Will he make these same allegations? Lots of things that have been upsetting or would be upsetting to the Chinese. According to the Daily Mail, this is what the Daily Mail writes about on the eve of the summit. Xi may also offer Chinese assistance in Trump's infrastructure renewal plan and a stake in China's newly established infrastructure bank, that's the AIIB. In exchange, according to the source, Xi Jinping will ask Donald Trump to delay planned weapon sales to Taiwan and loosen export restrictions on biotech and water treatment sectors. What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, facts do matter, maybe not so much in the long run, but facts eventually have a telling impact on politics and as well as economics. China is not a currency manipulator, and the small decline in China's currency and the small and incremental, slow and steady decline has been because the United States really encouraged China to float its currency in the international basket of other currencies. The impact of doing that was to, you know, because China is such an efficient producer, was to make the Chinese currency adjust so that the markets would accept Chinese products. So the markets, that's determined by market forces. So If someone believes that the economy or the currency is manipulated, that means there's government intervention. But in fact, it's entirely market forces that are determining the level of the Chinese RMB. So, you know, it's a political issue for the president, President Trump, in the United States. But it's not really an issue, I think, among economists. It's kind of like the failure, the systematic failure of the American economy over the past decade or two, where you have consistent job losses. And it's, you know, if you can have a bogeyman to blame for those job losses, like China or maybe Jewish bankers or something like that, then it's easier to explain away the failures of the economic system in the United States. But really, there are big factors that explain what's happening in the U.S., factors like productivity, the introduction of machinery and robots and software. Those are the factors that are changing the way Americans work. And it's not because Chinese workers are working for lower wages. Wages are rising very quickly in China. And here they're steady or perhaps even declining. For the infrastructure project, the president's America First program, I don't think can invite Chinese companies in to build the American infrastructure. Might be the best way to do it, really, because they're, in terms of the really large infrastructure equipment that's needed for this kind of project, China is the only country in the world that produces such machines. But this is, you know, the president's whole nationalist spin on his economic program, I think, means that he has to use American businesses, American-owned businesses when possible, to build the roadways, the pipelines, all the things, airports, the things that he talks about constantly. So I wouldn't be surprised if President Xi Jinping offered to let America join the IBB. That would be, why not? But I think it's inconsistent with what the America First program that President Trump ran on for him to accept such a deal. So it's one of those things, again, it's one of the contradictory things about the policies of the American right that is a little unfathomable and will have to be sorted out by history in your future.
Keith Bennett, the U.S. prints the world currency. In other words, you can clearly make the case that the U.S. is constantly manipulating currency because it can print them. It can print dollars, and the dollar is the world currency. It's been such since Bretton Woods in 1944, towards the close of World War II. It's the only government that can actually just print money, and it's pursued a policy of quantitative easing whereby the Treasury and the Federal Reserve actually gives banks money basically without strings attached and allows those banks to gamble, to play at the Wall Street casino, the stock exchange. Stock prices have been driven up. That, of course, draws foreign capital into the United States. It may be a bubble, but nonetheless, capital is flowing into the United States. I want you to actually talk, too, about the issue of, is China a currency manipulator? But I also want to, before you do, just introduce this one other point that the Chinese media was emphasizing prior to the visit of Xi Jinping to Florida. It says this: Xinhua mentioned that bilateral trade and investment created 2.6 million American jobs in 2015, and each American family saves $850 every year thanks to cheap Chinese goods. Now, that's from Xinhua, the Chinese news agency. That's one point. Holly Hart, the legislative director of the United Steelworkers Union, said of the meeting before it took place, President Trump needs to come away from the meeting with concrete deliverables that will restore production and employment here in the U.S. in those sectors that have been ravaged by China's predatory and protectionist practices. So China's making the argument they're actually helping the U.S. economy. The steel workers, and of course steel mills have closed here, are making the argument that China's predatory practices are what's taking steel jobs out of the United States. How do you see all of these issues?
Well, I think there's a comparison here with what happened in the U.S. a few days ago, or about a week ago, when Trump ripped up a lot of the energy policies of the Obama administration and had himself surrounded by some miners while he was doing it. And the big hype from Trump was that he was going to create a lot of mining jobs. But the reality was that it wasn't really those policies of the Obama administration that have led to the loss of mining jobs. It was the rise of automation, mechanization, changes in technology, and so on. And I think that Trump is really in a bind here, or you can say that U.S. capitalism strategically is in a bind, because what the United States needs is interaction with the world economy and cooperation with China to improve its infrastructure, but that becomes politically untenable if you have an America First policy, and it's for them to. It's for them to work out what they're going to do about that. With regard to currency manipulation, as you said, I remember even before Trump came on the scene, when the people in the United States were talking about China being a currency manipulator, and a Chinese official just turned to me and said two words: quantitative easing. There is no serious economist who now thinks that China is a currency manipulator. It's arguable that China was a currency manipulator, although I wouldn't particularly use that term for planning your economy. But it's arguable that China was a currency manipulator some time ago, but not in recent years. Even publications like the the New York Times simply say that this is not the case. When Trump says it's simply incorrect. And I don't think there's a serious economist, I'm not aware of a serious economist that considers China to be a currency manipulator at the present time. And within that context, I've read that Peter Navarro has actually never had an economics paper published in a peer-reviewed academic journal.
And Peter Navarro, of course, is the economic advisor who is so professionally hostile to China. I don't know what his book was, or The Coming War with China. David Ewing, do we know what's going on inside of the Trump administration when it comes to charting a policy on China? According to the New York Times, Robert A. Manning, a senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security, said, quote, "Bitter internal battles," close quote, "had erupted between Trump advisors who want to be more aggressive in challenging China on trade and those who counsel a more moderate tone. Trump's more moderate advisors appear to have persuaded him that it would be more effective and less risky to pursue his grievances through existing trade organizations." And then we had the South China Morning Post reported, and this was just yesterday, quote, "The removal of U.S. President Donald Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, who is known for his tough rhetoric against China, from the National Security Council will provide short-term relief to Beijing. The removal of Bannon on Thursday may reduce hawkish voices towards China, and the decision was announced ahead of the first face-to-face meeting between Trump and President Xi Jinping at the Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida." That's from the South China Morning Post. In other words, speculating or suggesting that the removal of Bannon could have had something to do with U.S. policy towards China. What do you think?
Well, that is an interesting number of comments you've heard. I've heard one or two of those, and especially the comments you made about the removal of Bannon, which was very surprising. It seemed to signal a shift away from the madcap, right-wing fantasy world that, that Breitbart had been promoting within the White House, of course. So, yeah, it's just hard for me to I don't have any particular insight about that, but I do think that the Trump government is riven by, prejudices of different kinds and not so much real analysis. So that's what makes it. I think that's what makes the meeting somewhat scary for the Chinese people. That's what part of the concern is about.
Okay, Keith Bennett, I want to ask you real quick, just on that, just very briefly, and then I want to turn to some other international questions. What do you think about what's going on inside the Trump administration and how it might be impacting China, or whether China is, in fact, a fundamental issue with this internecine intra-administration political struggle that seems to be playing itself out?
Well, I think one of the issues that makes this summit meeting tricky is that a big part part of the administration's Asia team has not even yet been put together. And it does, because Trump came into the presidential race as a political outsider, he's really not got a stable administration. Now, we numerous posts that should have been filled by this stage of the political cycle in the U.S. are still unfilled, and it's an inherently unstable coalition. It's interesting, as has been said, the speculation that the Bannon removal has got something to do with China. It's interesting. Personally, I doubt that was the main issue. I would see it much more that the U.S. ruling class is asserting itself against what it sees as mavericks.
And let's turn now to, in our last few minutes, to another issue that's obviously very impactful on U.S.-China policy, which is not simply a bilateral relationship because, you know, China and the Asia-Pacific region is the dynamic part of the world right now. 50% of the people of the planet live there. 40% of the world's GDP is produced there. We have the U.S. relationship with South Korea, which isn't an alliance. I mean, South Korea is an occupied country and has been occupied by the United States since 1950. It first occupied it in 1945. But there are political changes happening in South Korea, new government perhaps coming in following the impeachment of Park Geun-hye. That government might be opening up towards North Korea or wanting a reduction of tensions. We also have the situation in the Philippines, David Ewing, because Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, very unexpectedly from a U.S. point of view, you could see that they had been taken by surprise. He went to China about a year ago and said, well, they're breaking free. Philippines is breaking free from dependency on the United States, and signaled that the Philippines would try to sort out with China on a bilateral and friendly basis questions that are in dispute, like the islands that are disputed islands in the South China Sea, for instance. At the same time, and just recently, Chinese media, the Global Times, reported on the story that Duterte vows now to occupy the islands under pressure from pro-U.S. forces in the Philippines. In other words, I would think Philippine military forces who have been trained by the United States and Pentagon putting pressure on Duterte not to go with China. I mean, all of these things make the region very, very unstable right now. Go ahead. We have about 3 minutes left.
Yeah, and I don't see what the pattern will be. I think you'll see that China will continue to defend in its territories. China only has a small part of the world that has to defend, and that's, you know, the coastal region of China and, of course, its territory. So from a defense posture, I think China appears, the way I read China's military actions, they seem determined to defend the territory that they own. But beyond that, I don't think there's other ambitions. So countries dealing with China, I think, probably understand that. They may not completely accept all of China's claims, although I think China's claims are well-founded. But they don't see China as an expansive power. And they see there's a pattern of U.S. aggression against certainly Southeast Asia. So I think that these factors, although I don't see what's a clear path into the future, I think we'll see more determination. We'll see the realization of China's determination to hold on to its territories and defend them in a way. But China has not threatened its neighbors or expanded beyond its traditional claims. So I don't think there'll be they will not provoke a reaction.
Let me bring in Keith Bennett. Keith, we have about a minute left. One of the issues that's not on the agenda at the summit between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump is the issue of climate change. Trump once tweeted that a climate change was a hoax invented by the Chinese. Of course, the United States appears to be pulling out from the Paris Climate Treaty that Obama had made possible because of U.S.-Chinese cooperation. Where will China stand on this issue? We have about 30 seconds left.
Well, it's ironic that for years the United States tried to pressure China on the issue of climate change. China will now step up and give a strong leadership on climate change, irrespective of what the United States does. And that, for example, is already meeting with a very positive response from the European Union, reflected also in the fact that Xi Jinping made a state visit to Finland on his way to Florida. So if the U.S. steps aside from its climate change obligations, China, although it says it can't shoulder the whole burden of tackling global climate change, but it will forge other alliances around the world to exercise leadership on this.
Okay, and that was the voice of Keith Bennett. He's a China expert. We've been talking about the visit of Xi Jinping to Florida to meet Donald Trump. We've also been joined by David Ewing. He's the chair of San Francisco's chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. We will be back Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.